How did you discover investing?
How I discovered it? I, over time, had a love for or a fascination for compound interest. That's kind of what drew me to the area. That was first. And eventually, once I got more and more into it, I discovered I really enjoyed just learning about new businesses, trying to discover businesses. In terms of investing, you have to flip through thousands of ideas, thousands of stocks, learn about thousands of businesses before you find certain things. I think that's a lot of similarities to shooting hoops, taking practice shots. In the driveway, I was dreaming about hitting that game-winning shot in the NBA Finals. Mm-hmm. Never quite happened. But yeah, when you're researching stocks, you're kind of daydreaming of finding that one big investment. For a lot of investors, a few key decisions can kind of make your career there. So it's a treasure hunt that's fun, that you can kind of daydream about that happening to you.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. Welcome, esteemed listeners. Thank you so much for reaching out with your emails and messages. Your thoughts mean the world to me, and I will be responding shortly. Now, hold on to your seats, because June has been an absolute whirlwind of recording brilliance. I've had the honor of hosting an array of incredibly insightful guests. And guess what? To make sure you don't have to wait too long, I'm toying with the idea of a double treat, 2 episodes per week for a short burst. Keep your eyes peeled for this bounty of knowledge. If you're curious to hear more, don't forget to subscribe to my Substack. It's a treasure trove of articles, podcast episodes, and exclusive bonus content. A simple search with my name and you're in. Now, a heartfelt thank you for the wave of appreciation for my recent book, Crisis Investing. It's packed with 100 pandemic-era essays that are both a reflection of the times and timeless in their wisdom. The book's warm reception has led it to grace the top position in Amazon's new releases. If you haven't yet indulged, I cordially invite you to explore its pages. And if it speaks to you, do consider leaving a cherished review on Amazon and Goodreads. Now, with that, let's get started with our episode. In today's episode, we have the privilege of conversing with the accomplished Jacob McDonough, founder and portfolio manager of McDonough Investments, and the author of the insightful book, Capital Allocation: The Financials of a New England Textile Mill, 1955 to 1985. I was introduced to Jacob's book through my good friend Derek from Bangkok, who also kept me company at this year's Berkshire meeting in Omaha. While there, I had the opportunity to attend a panel discussion moderated by Jacob. Subsequently, I delved into his book and was thrilled when Jacob graciously agreed to join us for this podcast interview. Before we dive in, I'd like to mention that Jacob had recently launched an intriguing podcast himself. It's called the 10K Podcast, which I highly recommend. You can find the links in the notes. In our enlightening conversation today, Jacob unveils the fascinating narrative behind his book on Berkshire Hathaway. He shares his very unexpected lesson that stands out. He elaborates on the importance of not investing in certain businesses. He discusses the critical role of emotional discipline in making investment decisions. Jacob reveals the humble beginnings of Berkshire with some initially underperforming businesses. We identify 3 central themes in his book: the quest for capital, the masterful capital allocation, and Buffett's fondness for businesses with growing cash flows. We discuss Buffett's Berkshire's early history with the use of debt and capital raises. Jacob explores the variety of businesses Buffett favored, including newspapers and a toll bridge, and uncovers the commonalities they shared. Jacob offers a deep dive into the pivotal role See's Candies played in Berkshire's early financial success, emphasizing its margins, debt-free status, and minimal capital requirements. Jake McDonough's meticulous research and thoughtful writing make his book an invaluable resource for dedicated investors and followers of Buffett alike. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to the insightful and accomplished Jacob McDonough. Hello, Jacob. It's nice to see you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm a big fan of your book. You know that. It's a wonderful little book that we'll talk more about in a second. I had the pleasure of listening to you speak in Omaha not long ago, and I was really looking forward to this conversation. So I have a long list of questions. I always like to start from the beginning, as you can imagine, you see it coming. But I want to hear about your childhood and upbringing and how you think that time influenced your relationship with money and then led you to a career path that you're on right now.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Excited to be here. I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's where I grew up. And I had a very fortunate upbringing. Came from loving parents, a supportive family. So that's a great way to come up in terms of upbringing. Growing up, I loved to play basketball. I couldn't see it at the time, but looking back, I think there's a lot of similarities to what I loved about basketball and my day-to-day now in terms of investing. Games were great, but what I loved about basketball was being in the gym alone or the driveway alone, shooting hoops, taking practice shots. And I think, like I said, looking back, I think pretty meditative, kind of like a soothing process just doing that. And I think in terms of investing, you have to flip through thousands of ideas, thousands of stocks, learn about thousands of businesses before you, you know, find certain things. I think that's a lot of similarities to shooting hoops, taking practice shots. In the driveway, I was dreaming about hitting that game-winning shot in the NBA Finals. Mm-hmm. Never quite happened. But yeah, when you're researching stocks, you're kind of daydreaming of finding that one big investment. For a lot of investors, a few key decisions can kind of make your career there. So it's a treasure hunt that's fun that you can kind of daydream about that happening to you. And so I think it fits my personality. I'm more of an introverted guy, and I think I have a need or a desire for control in terms of my day-to-day and controlling my decision-making process. And I think investing, there's a lot of individual decision-makers, individual investors that have had success. And I don't know of too many very large committees that have had success investing over a long period of time, making a decision at, you know, as a committee. So it's like a single-player game, which fits me. Basketball is not exactly a single-player game, but what I liked about basketball was the you could do it alone in the driveway and kind of practice. So I think that's why it fits me.
How did you discover investing?
Yeah, so how I discovered it, I over time had a love for or a fascination for compound interest. That's kind of what drew me to the area. That was first, and eventually, once I got more and more into it, I discovered I really enjoyed just learning about new businesses, trying to discover businesses. Those were the two things. And compound interest is what led me to a fascination for Buffett and Berkshire. There's very few real life examples of compounding that are as long as Buffett's life or Berkshire. Buffett started investing or saving and making money maybe when he was 6. And, you know, he's in his 90s and he's still at it. Unfortunately, not many people last that long. And most people retire or go spend their money. So there's very few people who have done it that long. And Berkshire, a lot of companies fail before they reach Berkshire's age. And also, not many companies retain all their earnings and just keep compounding year after year. And so I think a lot of my fascination came from, it's just such an interesting real life example of compounding at work.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. You wrote an extraordinary book about Berkshire Hathaway. It's called Capital Allocation, The Financials of a New England Textile Mill, 1955-1985. Now, the title itself, it's a very humble title. Unless you find it in Omaha, you wouldn't know you're talking about Berkshire. So I'm curious about the title. And it's full of financials. It's very different than all the other books about Berkshire that I know, and I've read many. And it has very thoughtful commentary, and on top of it, your analysis of what was going on at the time. So walk me through it. Where did the idea come from? Tell me more about the title. And the book itself, it's very different, very unique.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the title, that's kind of funny. I think there's just so many books about Buffett and Berkshire. I think that's kind of how the title comes about in terms of, I guess I didn't exactly want to use Buffett's name, or I guess I didn't even use Berkshire's name, because that's been done so many times and there's so many great books about it. I'm an investor, so I'm a practitioner, and you know, a lot of the great books I read, the biographies and stuff, my favorite parts of them were some of the financial anecdotes you could find in them. But I was left wanting more. And so first I was going to track down this data just for my own benefit, just to learn from. And it was tough to find in libraries, especially for companies they acquired and invested in. When you're trying to track down financial detail from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was tough to find. So at first, I spent a lot of time tracking that down and analyzing it. So I figured some people might like to do that exercise themselves too, who didn't have the time to track down that data. And I self-published a book in May of 2020. So it's been 3 years now. And just the idea of self-publishing it and not going through any intermediaries was kind of a exciting idea to try out. So that was another thing that kind of got me down that path. But a lot's been covered on Buffett, the person, and his stock picking ability. But I think Berkshire, the company, is a little underrated in the structure and the benefits that come along with Berkshire. And so I really wanted to write the book from that perspective and write the book from what an investor could have seen in 1965, just looking at public details, financials, annual reports, and stuff like that. And I'm someone who thinks there's opportunity to take advantage of the Berkshire structure, and a dream job it is to allocate capital at a company. And so I really wanted to put myself in Buffett's shoes in 1965 and think through some of the decisions he made, and just thinking about how it's almost a $1 trillion company now, and it all came from 3 failed businesses. And so trying to be a practitioner, if I put all my net worth into 3 businesses and you told me in 20 years they're going to be worthless, I wouldn't think, how do I create a $1 trillion company out of this? A lot of fear would come to mind, and I'd think, how do I just get my money back and salvage this investment of these failed businesses I'm taking over? And so that's some of the background on how it came about.
A very unlikely story when you think about it, and you highlight that in the book. And when you think about it, they didn't really make it easy for themselves. Why start with 3 very weak businesses? And we'll come back to that. But the one remarkable thing about Buffett and Munger and Berkshire for me is that every time I read, learn, and study them in different books, including yours, I find something new. So I'm curious, what's been your number one new lesson you walked away with after all this study and research for the book? Was there something that you didn't know before, or you saw it with fresh eyes and it really stood out?
There were a lot of lessons for me. Insurance and banking, I learned a lot because those were 2 of the most important acquisitions they made right away. It was important to see how flexible and opportunistic they were, all the pivots they've made over time. And just little things like that, purchase prices they had, and little things like they took on more debt than I would have assumed just from listening to the annual meetings in recent years and reading the letters. There was a lot of little things I picked up on, but the biggest lesson for me was insurance and the use of float. Because ever since maybe around the 90s, Berkshire got large enough where they're able to use the float, which is policyholder liabilities in terms of insurance, use the float however they wanted. And that was just because of size. But it really was not like that before the 90s. And I guess, so that's 30 years of Berkshire being able to operate that way. So it makes sense, someone who's just started following Berkshire after the 90s, I mean, not till after the 2000s, but National Indemnity was the first insurance company Berkshire acquired. And National Indemnity looked like a more traditional insurance company. And for the time period my book covers, was a more traditional insurance company, which means the float, the policyholder liabilities, was more in fixed income, and the equity capital or the shareholders' funds could be in stocks. And so if I try to acquire an insurance company today, that's how I would have to operate. Berkshire is very unique in how they can operate. They can buy stocks with their float, or the railroad they own, Burlington Northern, BNSF, was bought through National Indemnity. No one else can really do that. And so that was a big lesson. And learning why insurance was still attractive, even though in those early days, National Indemnity was still an attractive acquisition, even though they couldn't use the float how they do today. And a big reason for that was that the equity capital, the shareholders' funds, could be in stocks. And Buffett, as a money manager, was going to have stocks whether or not he bought that company. Insurance, you don't need capital to operate in terms of inventory or equipment or property. But you do need capital to fall back on in case there's losses from policies. And so like the book value of National Indemnity, the equity capital was all in stocks. And so that part of the purchase price for Buffett didn't really matter because he was going to own those stocks whether or not he made the acquisition. And so the goodwill he paid was all that really mattered. And I think he paid $1.9 million of goodwill in the transaction. And so float was maybe 10 times the goodwill he paid. So the fixed income portfolio he would have on that float was definitely going to cover the goodwill he paid and make that an attractive acquisition. And then the book value would take care of itself because you had Warren Buffett managing that stock portfolio. And so one thing I never realized until writing the book is that float today, how he uses it is different. But back then, insurance was attractive because he was able to leverage his equity portfolio into additional income streams in terms of fixed income and underwriting profits. And I didn't realize that till writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Additional capital. We'll come back to insurance float and the use of debt. I actually thought of it as a very interesting observation you just mentioned, the use of debt in the early years. And I want to come back to price sensitivity, how the two of them, especially Buffett, was very price sensitive at times when it comes to purchases, but we'll come back to it. But before we get there, there was this one quote that I really liked that I wanted to share with you. You write, "The decisions to not invest in certain companies might have been more important than the investment decisions Berkshire did make." And I love this sentence, and I often share in my books and articles that what's not in the portfolio often matters as much as if not more than what is in the portfolio. And it's basically the money we didn't lose. Tell me more about that quote and why you picked up on it and why it was, you know, so important for you to mention it in the book.
Yeah, there are two reasons I had that in there. The first would be how important it is to avoid losing money. And the second thing is opportunity cost. So in terms of losing money, Buffett's really avoided major blowups. And when you're compounding, anything times zero is zero, no matter how big of a company you get. Mm-hmm. And so if you're really concerned about having a very long career or building a company that lasts decades or maybe even a century, you really have to watch the downside. And that's something through this period, and I mean, through Berkshire's life, there's been plenty of crises. And, you know, Berkshire, there was never a time where they're really close to going bankrupt, not even close to that. So there was never a time Buffett even had to stress or stay awake at night worrying about if his company was going to survive. They were profitable really throughout this whole period. So he definitely made mistakes, but they definitely avoided blowups. And that's very important on a long-term track record. But opportunity cost is another reason I had that quote in there, just because I was very cautious of hindsight bias. And I know I'm biased. There's no way you can get rid of all that bias. It was bias when you're writing a book, especially after Berkshire's been so successful and we've seen everything that's happened. But since I was trying to put myself in the perspective of what an investor could have seen in 1965 and seen as the transition happened, I was just trying to be mindful of the biases involved and trying to at least reduce the effect of that. But when you're judging an investment or an acquisition, you really need to compare it to all the other options you have in the world. And my book doesn't really take that into account at all. That's one reason I highlighted that. I do try to compare to what interest rates were at the time, because an acquisition in one time period might look good, whereas in a different environment, not so much. So opportunity cost is an important part of the investment process, and you don't always get that point of view when looking back at history.
That's very true. We'll come back to what Berkshire was at the time and what was becoming. But before we get there, I'm curious about the emotional discipline. And you might know, I'm sure you know, that Buffett wrote the foreword to Benjamin Graham's Intelligent Investor, and he says that everything is included in the book except for the emotional discipline, the temperament that you need to succeed as an investor. And even this year at the annual meeting, he was asked about being emotional making investment decisions, and he said it's been a while. But I specifically want to ask about Berkshire Hathaway itself, because this was meant to be a relatively short-term investment, very much in the style of traditional Benjamin Graham investment, almost, you know, a cigar butt or close to it. And he ended up buying more of it and having a controlling stake and eventually turning Berkshire into the conglomerate and investment vehicle that it became. But that wasn't the plan. And it was all about pennies that he argued about or disagreed about with the seller of the shares, or the buyer of the shares in this case. Tell me more about the context and what happened. And was this an emotional decision?
Yeah, they're able to avoid emotional decisions, but you're right. Berkshire, he's talked about a few times, itself was an emotional decision. I think that he met with the CEO and the CEO offered to buy back his stock at a certain price, and it was maybe an eighth of a dollar lower, something like that. And that's when he decided to take over the company. So you could say there's some emotion involved there. I think in the HBO documentary, he talked about that it was an emotional decision. I think he brought up the fact his dad died around that time, maybe within a year or something like that. So he has talked about emotions there. And in the book, I did write about some reasons why buying Berkshire was a mistake. And I still agree with some of the points I made there. But now that I have time to soak in some of the material I wrote, I do think it is a little more nuanced than I gave it credit for in the book. I wish I would have explored that a little more. Just in terms of, I'm sure it was a mistake on a personal level when you have a dying business. I'm sure that's hard to handle, whether or not knowing you might have to let people go versus a business that's always growing and you're always hiring more people. That's probably a lot more fun on a personal level. And then, but instead of Berkshire, he could have acquired National Indemnity fully, and everything we know today from Berkshire could be all Buffett's instead of having other shareholders along for the ride. And Berkshire, the textile mill, dragged down the return on capital in the early days. So those were some of the reasons I said it was a mistake in the book. But looking back, in his first 2 years when he took over Berkshire, he got almost all his cash back right away, and he was able to redeploy that. And then the other thing was, it was selling for such a discount in terms of price to book value. By the time my book ends in 1985, it was selling for a premium. So just leveraging capital that's a discounted, reallocating it, and getting it to sell for a premium, that leverage along with the cash he got out right away, I think makes the discussion more nuanced and not so much of a mistake as is kind of like the legend nowadays.
I think it's, yeah, he found a way to turn it around and turn it into something better and bigger, and we'll talk more about it. I'm thinking in terms of investments, you know, when we invest, sometimes an investment can become a distraction. And I think the textile operations were a distraction really for the next 15 to 20 years. I think most of the time covered by your book all the way to the 80s. And when you think about the time and the attention, it could have been somewhere else, spent somewhere else. But point being, he got the money back and continued and turned it into a huge success either way. So I wouldn't cry over it too much. I think it's just interesting. Now, we manage money for families, multi-generational wealth, and it's some of the legacy clients have had fortunes for many generations, and newer clients just created wealth and aspire to have their wealth last over the long run. And the fascinating thing that I see that rhymes with Berkshire's story is that you might have made a fortune in one single business, but it might not be the same business that will allow you to perpetuate this wealth over time. And the textile mills were a decent business with high profits for a period of time, very competitive, never really a good business, but at least created, you know, cash flows. And Adam Mead, who you might know, who wrote the other book about Berkshire recently, he shares how the whaling fortunes of the Northeast put money in the textile mills. So you have the fortunes being reinvested in the next business, in the next business. And in your book, we meet Berkshire Hathaway at the time where textile mills were not a good business to be in anymore. And Buffett knew that. But look, the same way family fortunes find a new place for the fortune to continue, that fortune and those cash flows and that capital found a new place in new businesses too. So I see how it rhymes with multi-generational wealth that could outlast the original business. I'm curious about the mistakes and what's inspiring to, I think, all of us, aspiring investors and professional investors, is the fact that Buffett and Munger made so many mistakes, and they're very honest about it. They talk about it, they share it, they kind of rub it in their own faces so many times. Can you talk about that aspect of their success? And you briefly talked about the fact that the whole Berkshire story started with three not so good or maybe even bad businesses. How can you overcome so many mistakes and still do just fine investing?
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the reasons my book covers till 1985. That's when the textile mill closed down. So I did 10 years before Buffett took over, what did Berkshire look like, and then the transition that happened all the way until the textile mill closed down. So I mentioned it started with three failed businesses. So the first was the original Berkshire textile mill. Blue Chip Stamps is the second. And then Hochschild Cone was bought through an entity called Diversified Retailing. Mm-hmm. All three of those businesses were basically failed and out of business by 1985. The type period my book covers. And so all three of those merged together in the time period my book covers. They were separate entities at first, but by 1965, Buffett basically had all his net worth in those three businesses. Diversified retailing is interesting because that's Charlie Munger, Sandy Gottesman, and Buffett formed that entity. They wanted to acquire a bunch of retailers. They bought two. Hotshot Cone was the first, and they bought Associated Cotton, I believe it was. Then they realized they made a mistake. They sold Hotshot Cone. So one of the three failed businesses I mentioned, they actually sold pretty quickly. The other two they held on to. But so they sold Hotshot Cone and bought stock in Berkshire and Blue Chip instead. And so they had a master plan of acquiring a bunch of retailers. They ended up having two stocks and one retailer in that entity. So not very diversified, not very much in retailing. But eventually that merged into Berkshire. Blue Chip Stamps, discount program for retailers. It was a good business for a while, but eventually retailing changed and all of a sudden stores weren't really using the discount program that Blue Chip Stamps offered. And so eventually sales went to about zero. But they were able to, that business generated float, like a deferred revenue. And so they were able to make acquisitions and make investments with the float that still made Blue Chip attractive. But still, the original business of Blue Chip failed in this time period. And then the textile mill failed. So especially with diversified and the original textile mill, that kind of shows how they're able to pivot out of the old business. And maybe they made a master plan and they're able to change their mind and pivot. And if you're going to have a company that lasts decades or centuries, you have to be nimble. You have to be opportunistic. You have to look at the environment and see what opportunities are actually out there and adapt to what's out there and keep changing. Especially nowadays, there's a lot of innovations, a lot of changes. So companies have to be able to adapt like Berkshire.
When you think about it, you know, we're looking at a textile mill that was funded with the Whaling fortunes all the way through the businesses you mentioned and many others that we'll talk about in a second, all the way to Apple and iPhone, right? And the capital got reinvested in very different businesses and continued, which is pretty remarkable because some of the businesses were clearly, you know, dead ends. You couldn't stay in them forever. You had to pivot. There are at least three big themes that I see in your book. And one of them is the search for a pool of capital to invest. So it was insurance float that you mentioned, and I'm curious to hear more about. A bank that they bought, and Blue Chip Stamps. If you can mention more about it to the audience that's less familiar with the story. So that's number one theme, looking for the capital. Second, smart capital allocation away from bad businesses towards better businesses. And then appreciation of growing cash flow streams. And we'll transition to See's Candies in a minute. But a pool of capital away from bad to good. And then the third one is in search of the cash flow streams, which builds the capital that we started with. Can you talk about that framework? Because it's really interesting and it's so visible when Berkshire was still such a small operation back then in those decades that you describe.
Yeah, I think one big theme is that capital is fungible or money is fungible. Like I mentioned earlier, it didn't matter if stocks were going to be within the insurance company or at the parent company, or I guess Buffett would have had him stocks in his personal account. It didn't really matter where that money was in, where the cash was in. Buffett could kind of do whatever he wanted with it, whether it was in the insurance company or not. And a lot of the acquisitions they made, like See's Candy, there's a lot of overcapitalized firms that, you know, had a great business, eventually ran out of room for reinvestment, and cash was piling up on the balance sheet. And so he could buy that company. Basically, a lot of his purchase price could be buying that cash, and he could send that cash elsewhere. It was fungible. It didn't exactly matter where the cash was in. He was able to redeploy it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so that's something you see over and over again in the story, is that that's one reason why the Berkshire structure is so important, is because no company, very few companies can keep reinvesting capital for decades. You might fill a niche and eventually you kind of hit your ceiling and you might have high returns on capital in your business, but you run out of room to expand. And so a company like Berkshire can take that capital, reinvest it elsewhere, and still yet have the safety of having that capital on hand in case maybe a subsidiary is going through a tough time. If you're paying out as a dividend, that money's gone. And so a See's Candy as a standalone company might keep more cash on hand than it would really need to if it's within Berkshire. And similar with the insurance companies, Berkshire, the parent company, had so much capital that, you know, it provided a lot of safety for the insurance companies. And so See's Candy was one example where over half their assets on the balance sheet were cash before they bought the company. Mm-hmm. And so that brings up, that was something I found in libraries. I had no idea that data on See's Candy went back decades before Buffett bought the company. In Moody's manuals, there was See's Candy, National Indemnity, Illinois National Bank in Rockford, which was a very unique bank. I was able to find data going back a couple of decades for all those businesses, which was a lot of fun to look at. But yeah, I'd be happy to talk about any of those individual businesses if you'd find that interesting.
So to me, what's clear is that Buffett was not married to any of the industries that he would invest in. And I think that's a big difference between looking at any other company in the world where I'm thinking of companies that used to print checks. Like 10 to 20 years ago, I remember looking at high cash flow on the balance sheet companies that print checks for the banks. I forgot the names. There were a few of them. And they're kind of dying business with shrinking revenue, but just very high cash flow. And you would think that this company didn't need to pivot into it. They needed somebody like Buffett, a capital allocator that would take that cash flow and go into a different direction. That's the blessing that this textile mill that you decided to write about had, that capital allocator that was not married to the textile industry and was willing to pivot to different industries. That was really interesting. The second thing that I noticed, and it's a transition to the next question I have about the capital raises, the debt. Berkshire, at the time when you started the story, didn't really have much debt. It had cash on the balance sheet. Am I right?
Right. Yeah, it had some cash. It was buying back stock, which was very unique for that time period. So it was already making a few unique capital allocation decisions, shutting down some plants, generating capital that way.
So it sounds like a very responsible management to begin with, because in the future, in the following decades, I've seen examples of companies stuck in a position like this with what I would call a secular decline of the original industry, where instead of admitting that's the case and doing what they did, buybacks and return the cash and, you know, wait for Buffett to appear, which was a miracle more than a given, they would borrow more money and waste that money on acquisitions that had limited incremental value to the business. So it was a very disciplined approach, and it might be the fact that it was 1950s and it was still soon after the Great Depression and use of debt and how responsible the management was. When I was reading your book, I was thinking somebody really responsible was still running this company. Obviously didn't have the magic touch of Buffett, but still the company was managed in a very responsible way. Can you talk about the capital raises and the use of debt that you touched on early on? I'm curious about that because we think of Buffett as somebody very disciplined. He says, if you don't need to borrow, don't borrow. Munger, I believe, borrowed some in the 70s, used some leverage in his investment partnership that cuts both ways, as you know. But they did opportunistically borrow some money back in the day, and you mentioned that in the book. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, they did use more debt than I would have thought. It was never too aggressive compared to the average company, but it was just more than I would have expected. And I think an interesting comparison would be in recent years, Munger bought some shares in Alibaba. I can't remember if he still owns it through the Daily Journal company. And some people were shocked to see he used a little margin debt to buy those shares. And I think it kind of ties back to how he's always operated, even Berkshire, Blue Chip, Diversified, how they operated even in the early days. They were very focused on liquidity and very, very safe from a liquidity standpoint. So Blue Chip stamps, I already mentioned earlier, they had some deferred revenue and they had some float, even though it was not an insurance business. It was a, you know, discount program for retailers. But I always thought they acquired businesses with a float. They kind of did and kind of didn't. So they bought like the Buffalo News newspaper through Blue Chip and bought See's Candy through Blue Chip. And you could kind of say they bought those with the float of the stamps. The reason I'm saying they kind of did and kind of didn't is because before they made those acquisitions, all of the float was in stocks and cash, basically. So Blue Chip had a lot of stocks. But when they made these acquisitions, they wouldn't sell their stocks. They would basically take on debt. So I know in the Buffalo News example, I believe they took on debt for the whole acquisition of the newspaper. Again, not too aggressive in terms of the size, the total capital of the whole company. But they did fund that, I think, completely with debt. And so instead of selling stocks to make the acquisition, which number one, you might have to pay taxes on, and two, you have less liquidity in case of a tough time, They would keep that liquidity, keep the stocks, but they took on debt. So you could say they bought, made the acquisition with the float because they could always sell those stocks and pay off the debt. I guess you could say the debt was either for the business or the debt's against the stocks. I mean, it, either way, I guess it doesn't really matter. And so I think that kind of ties to how they've always operated. Even if you look at Munger with that Alibaba stock position, he didn't sell his other stocks to make that purchase. He might have took on a little bit of a margin loan. Again, I think that just more ties back to liquidity and not that he was trying to leverage up and juice his gains in that one stock decision. I think it ties back to how they've always operated. Mm-hmm. And so the debt they took on, though, was always very long-term. It was at least 10 years or more, 20-year debt. And, you know, they're always growing and making more acquisitions. So in a way, they're almost always refinancing because in 5 years, if they made a larger acquisition and took on some debt, you know, they could pay off that old loan. And all of a sudden, they have a debt that's not due for 20 more years. Mm-hmm. It's kind of you could think of it as refinancing. They were liquid. They had stocks to go against that debt too. They had the operating businesses. They had profits coming in. So it was very safe, but it just is not what I pictured from listening to the recent annual meetings in the letters.
So it was opportunistic, but still very cautious and disciplined. It sounds like it. So when I was reading your book, what I noticed, especially in those early days, there were three types of businesses that kind of appear, or interesting types of businesses. Obviously, newspapers that became a bigger, longer-term theme. But there was also a toll bridge that they owned and a detective agency. You have to tell me more.
Yeah. So I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The toll bridge they tried to acquire is in Detroit, other side of the state from where I'm living. So they bought, I believe, 20% of the company. It was a publicly traded stock. So they bought stock in the bridge. And they tried to buy the whole thing. They got outbid, and the gentleman who ended up outbidding them slightly and buying the bridge, he became a billionaire, and that was mostly his only asset. And so I believe, I don't know for sure, that the valuation of the bridge company might have only been $20 million or somewhere near there at the time. And the person who bought it eventually was a billionaire from that. But the toll bridge is an interesting investment because like See's Candy, it was another overcapitalized company, had a ton of cash on the balance sheet. I believe over half of their assets were cash because they weren't able to reinvest it. They weren't building any more bridges. They just had one bridge. And it dominated the commercial traffic. It went to Canada, Detroit to Canada. And a lot of the trucking traffic from that area, from the Midwest and all around, would go through. It was the most efficient way to get to Canada or from Canada into the U.S. either way. So it was an important bridge for the area. You know, you'd think you could raise prices over time due to inflation, and you really didn't have to lay out too much more CapEx because the bridge was already built. You'd have to, you know, maintain it over time, but you really didn't have to go build a whole nother bridge. And so I loved studying that one because Buffett makes a lot of analogies to a toll bridge is a great business, a great investment analogy, but it was cool. He almost bought one. So that would have been, I'm sure that would have been a funny part to the story if that transaction actually went through in the 70s. But that was
he owned some of it. He owned some of it, right? At some point.
Yeah, he owned about 20% of the stock. And then I believe they tried to make it a full acquisition, but someone just outbid them.
Mm-hmm. And what about the detective agency? How did that come about?
Yeah, Pinkerton's, which was kind of a infamous detective agency. It had a very long history that dated back. I believe Abraham Lincoln had their Pinkerton detectives or guards who protected Abraham Lincoln at some point in time. The railroads would use a lot of Pinkerton detectives in the early days. And eventually it got a lot of infamy through some of the big industrial companies back in the day. There were some strikes that turned deadly, I believe, kind of involving Pinkerton agents. So it has a very long history. There was a lot of fictional books written about Pinkerton detectives as well. But by the time they got involved, the business was very different. They were more of like a security firm. And that was another one where they bought a big chunk of the company. It was a stock, again, overcapitalized firm that didn't need much capital to operate, was very cash generative, cash built up on the balance sheet, and they had very little use to reinvest. So it's another one where they could have taken over the company, reallocated capital more efficiently. They bought the stock in the open market, and I believe they got close to 20% of that company as well. And then someone else acquired the company eventually. I believe in one of the annual meetings, a long time ago, like in the 90s, you can listen to some of the annual meetings on CNBC there. I believe they talked about, they had an offer to buy it. Pinkerton's got brought to them where they could have acquired the whole company. And I believe they avoided it just from a liability standpoint in case something went wrong with like the security team. Berkshire is such a wealthy corporation that they didn't want to be on the hook for any major liabilities and stuff like that. But a lot of these companies seize the bridge, Pinkerton's, overcapitalized, and the Berkshire structure just could have had that cash reinvested more efficiently.
Yeah, that's the theme. And, you know, people coming to Berkshire's meeting, they all walk away with boxes of See's candies. And by the last day, I think most of them are gone from what I could tell. And this company played a big role in Berkshire's early cash flow streams. You know, when they bought it, it had good margins, no debt. You just mentioned the cash on the balance sheet. I would add the limited capital needs that you point out in the book. You don't really need a lot of money to reinvest. And then you write in the book how in 1982, so a number of years after the purchase, See's made up a quarter of Berkshire's total revenue and more than half of its pre-tax operating profits. It's a really big share. Can you talk about that? It played a huge role at the time in building up the strength of what Berkshire could become and has become.
Yeah, that's really interesting because like you just pointed out, it was very important in this time frame. And today, it's not very important in terms of the size of the company because Berkshire's grown so much and See's was unable to grow. So See's is very popular on the West Coast of the United States. There's no See's candy in Michigan where I'm from, and out East, there's not too much. So I don't know exactly why, but chocolate is one thing that just does not travel well. You know, in different parts of the U.S., there's different, you know, popular brands. And in Europe, there's different ones in the U.S. And I don't know exactly why Coca-Cola travels everywhere, but chocolate does not. But yeah, See's ran out of room to reinvest. So it was very important, though. Like, it was a big size of the company in terms of profits during this time period. And that was really important. Kept throwing off cash they could reinvest elsewhere. But it's also important from the insurance aspect, especially around the 80s. Insurance went through a big decline in revenue. And so for a company like Berkshire to survive many decades and hopefully centuries being in insurance, you have to be able to say no to bad sales, which sounds easy, but in insurance, you get cash right away and you worry about problems later, which is difficult for human nature, you know, difficult to say no to that cash right away. And a lot of other companies have short-term sales goals or earnings goals. And so it might be tempting to kind of lower your price a little bit to hit that sales goal. And over time, you kind of lower it a little more to keep getting that additional sale. So Berkshire proved time and time again that they would not do that. So they had the culture in place to say no to bad business, especially a culture of no quarterly earnings goals or sales estimates or whatever. But besides the culture, the structure of Berkshire really allowed for that too, because the profits from See's Candy during the 80s could completely cover like the corporate overhead of the insurance business. So their insurance revenue, I think, dropped by over 60% at some point in the 80s, especially in terms of reinsurance revenue premium. So really, in the book, I try to point out that the insurance business in terms of sales could have been zero and See's Candy still could have funded like the corporate overhead indefinitely at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important from that aspect to support like the insurance company. They needed a cash cow to kind of support up the company because the textile mill was not going to be that. And so I think a lot of people, when they think, there have been some people who have tried maybe to recreate like a Berkshire structured company. There's a few companies that are similar to it, maybe like a Markel. But I think sometimes the people who have failed, it doesn't show that it's impossible to replicate, but it's just so important. That first company you buy, you got to be able to take some cash out of it or generate cash from that business. And then the next acquisitions you make, they better keep producing cash for you for it to work. And See's is one where, you know, they just made a great acquisition and it kept spitting out cash flow for them to keep growing. So no, it's very important to their growth.
Yeah, remarkable story. When I was doing research for my previous book, Money, Life, Family, I was curious about family fortunes that lasted and that stayed in one single business. Because usually the story is that the money is made in one business, then either it moves to real estate And then usually what follows is a portfolio of businesses, sort of like Berkshire, that can perpetuate the wealth. But the one industry where families could have stayed and stayed in the same industry was confectionery, chocolates, sweets, candy, because it's not subject to change. And you could imagine that the same products or similar products people liked 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and 200 years ago. So you would see those stories around the world of families that kept their original confectionery business and were able to still have the purchasing power or even bigger purchasing power down the road, even with not extreme growth opportunities, but at least some sustainable growth without big capital needs. But there was more of an exception than a rule, and a family would stay with one single business. But See's Candy makes me think of those stories.
That's a great point because, you know, you'd think of it as a negative that C's can't expand, but really you could think of it that that means they have a really competitive advantage in, on the West Coast. Since they can't expand, you know, the other chocolate competitors you'd assume in other areas of the world can't expand to the West Coast too. So even though you don't have as many growth opportunities, it kind of protects your position there as well.
You have a very loyal local clientele, but it can be big enough that you could have a very nice business that will outlast us all, you know, and the other categories are alcohol, beer, and a handful of other businesses that have not changed. And but most of the businesses followed the path of the textile mills. You had to reinvest the money somewhere else to survive. You couldn't overstay your welcome. There is a quote in your book that I read in the past, and I'll read it to you, and that really made me think again about investing and purchasing power of money and inflation and everything else related. So I'll read you the quote, and I'm curious about your thoughts. And you know which quote it is, I'm guessing. Buffett wrote, "One friendly but sharp-eyed commentator on Berkshire has pointed out that our book value at the end of 1964 would have bought about 1/2 ounce of gold. And 15 years later, after we have plowed back all earnings, along with much blood, sweat, and tears, the book value produced will buy about the same 1/2 ounce. And he says the same thing happened to oil. Tell me more about that period, because what he's pointing out is that the dollar lost so much in its purchasing power in that period, and it's a 1979 letter, so the 70s. That all the work they did to grow as a business when dominated in, expressed in gold pretty much has not changed. There's a lesson there and a painful lesson. And we might, the history rhymes and we might be experiencing something like this just now in, you know, 2023 with some inflation and some other things happening. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, inflation's bad. Warren Buffett and Munger, they've always been concerned about inflation, and rightfully so. And that's good for him to point that out to his investors, because, I mean, he had great returns, but he points out, he's always quick to point out some of the negatives or the drawbacks to what they've achieved. So to me, one of the important pieces of that, though, is a little different. So he points out the 15-year period. And then in my book, I talk about that, but if you extend 5 more years to the comparison, so instead of 15 years, you do 20 years, it looks very different. And so I think for me, I always try to keep that in mind, because you might look at someone's 15-year track record and think, oh, that's a long time. So is this strategy valid or not? 15 years should give me the answer, but it's not always that clear. So for example, during the time period Buffett's talking about, 15 years, Berkshire's book value compounded at 20.4% per year. Mm-hmm. Great job. Gold over that same time period went up 20.7% per year in value. So gold outperformed in that 15-year period, outperformed Berkshire in terms of book value increase. But then gold went down quite a bit in value the next 5 years. So over a 20-year period, if you extend that just 5 more years, Berkshire far outperformed the value of gold. So Berkshire went up 24% per year over a 20-year period in terms of its book value. And over the 20 years, gold went up 11.7% per year. And so to me, I try to keep in mind, you know, if a 5-year period can really change, you know, the net result, maybe you don't put as much weight towards it. But I think about Berkshire today, there's definitely been five-year periods in recent years where Berkshire has underperformed the S&P, but I could be wrong here, but I think Berkshire would have to decline 99% this year to get back to the level of the S&P from 1965 till today. So I guess what I'm saying is the next 5 years of Berkshire, the S&P is not going to be able to catch up in this next 5 years from the cumulative from where Berkshire started till today. So to me, that's a more of a worthwhile, valid strategy that Buffett put together and a valid track record, maybe compared to the gold comparison. So that's kind of how I think about that quote and mm-hmm. what I try to talk about in my book.
And a very peculiar time. So I know it highlights some things that the dollar was gold, but it was not really a free market in gold until the 70s. And then once gold was freed up from a price that was set in the 30s, gold was catching up. And Berkshire in the same period of time was buying quality businesses and reinventing itself and setting stage for the success of the future. So reading this quote, one impression would be, oh, I wish I had held gold in that period. But the second thought that you say is, well, Berkshire set itself up for a huge success and gold was not looking so good in the following few years. So it's something to think about as we were thinking about inflation, about purchasing power of money, the talk about debt ceiling and easy money policies, all the things that are in people's minds, the macro conversation, and compare that with the ownership of businesses. Berkshire did just fine. You write about the big leap that you touched on in value of Berkshire. So in 1962, you write in your book that Buffett paid $7.50, let's say, for his initial purchase of Berkshire stock. Then in 1985, so 62 to 85, in 85, Berkshire reached $2,730 per share from $7.50. Now, that's a massive move. I think you say it's 363 times higher than it was in 62, in 85. And you quote the annual growth rate of 29% when the S&P grew 7%. Now, such a massive leap. And then the worth of the company went up from, I believe, around 12 million to 3.1 billion with a B. I'm curious, what drove this value increase? What would you highlight as the number one, two, three things that drove this, I mean, eye-popping increase in value of a company?
Yeah, so it is pretty interesting to break down where the returns came from. And so the stock price did compound at 29.2% per year from when Buffett first bought the stock in 1962 mm-hmm. until when my book ends in 1985. And so book value grew at 19.3% per year. And so the book value growth just came from reinvesting earnings. And so they didn't, you know, raise additional equity capital. They didn't really pay dividends. And so basically you'd say since they're retaining all their earnings, they earned 19.3% of capital on average, reinvested that back in the business. And that's how they grew their book value. And so over the long term, you'd expect the share price to follow the return on capital of the business. But in this case, it kind of diverged quite a bit, 29% stock price growth versus the book value grew 19%. And so the reason for the difference is pretty interesting. So number one, it was lower because the textile mill dragged down the returns on capital over time in the early days. But the difference was made up from the change in price of book value, leveraging discounted capital. The way I look at it, as I wrote it down here, the price to book value was 0.372 when Buffett first invested in Berkshire. And by 1985, it was at 1.661 price to book value. So if you just go from 0.3 to 1.7 over a 23-year period, that is a 6.7% compound annual return that comes from the change in price to book value. And so adding the book value growth adding the book value growth with that 6.7% juice you get from leveraging discounted capital into capital selling for a premium basically makes up for the difference between what book value grew at and what the stock price grew at. There's 3% left over that can be attributable to other things like they had some share repurchases in the early days. And so I wish I would have added a little more color to that in the book because I think that makes it nuanced when Buffett says it was a mistake buying a textile mill that had low returns on capital. But really, if you think about it, if you pay book value for a company that earns 29% per year over a long period, you know, your value should go up 29% per year. I don't think anyone would call that a mistake. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. But you also could buy a firm that has lower returns on capital, selling at more of a discount valuation. And then in the case like Berkshire, if you're able to improve operations and reallocate capital better and get it to be worth premium, that leverage can kind of make up the difference. And so I think it's interesting breaking down where that came from in terms of book value growth versus, you know, valuation differences.
Well, since you mentioned that, I have to ask, had he skipped that step and put the capital he put in Berkshire directly into the businesses that Berkshire ended up owning in those few years that followed, right? So pretty much skipping a couple of things. One, wasting time and energy on managing a failing business. And two, going directly into the businesses that he really wanted to acquire. And maybe he needed some time to discover See's Candy still and go in the direction of quality. But just skipping the step of owning a textile mill, I mean, it would have sped him up a little bit, no?
I really do think he could have skipped that step, but I think it'd be pretty equivalent either way. He would have saved the headache, and on a personal level, it would have been much easier to skip the Berkshire step, the textile step. And from a managerial standpoint, I'm sure you spend a lot more time on the problem businesses versus the good businesses. And so also you have the risk of maybe he couldn't have got the capital out of textiles because it was a very cyclical business, and the Berkshire textile mill did produce cash his first 2 years owning the business, but it's cyclical. So, you know, it could have been losses in those years instead. So maybe there's a little bit of luck that he was able to get capital out those first 2 years, but he also cut costs in the first 2 years. Cost of goods sold dropped by 10%. So on one hand, maybe there's a little luck that he was able to get cash out, but again, he did a great job in terms of operations, cutting costs and getting cash out. The valuation of Berkshire was $12 million when he first invested. And they had pre-tax profits of over $9 million his first 2 years he took over. They had tax credits, tax loss carry forwards because of losses in previous years. So that was really over $9 million of after-tax free cash flow that came from the textile mill when the valuation was just $12 million when he first invested. So you're right. He could have skipped it. I think it would have been equivalent, but he should have skipped it. And it would have been a big mistake if he was unable to get that cash out of there those first 2 years.
I always like to ask my guests about their definition of success. And I'm curious to hear yours. What's your own personal, professional definition of success?
What's really important to me is balance. And I think about that both from a personal aspect and a professional aspect. So I love spending time with my family. It's a lot of fun. I have a wife and two young daughters, and I love spending time with them. I love investing too. And I'm pretty competitive, so I do want to earn as high of a return on capital as I can, you know, in terms of compound returns. But I want to balance that with going for as long a time period as I can too, because if you look at Buffett, he did high returns and he had a very long runway. But if you look at someone maybe like Peter Lynch, who had high returns but kind of got burnt out on the day-to-day, I love investing, so I want to kind of protect that love and make sure I can do this for the rest of my life and keep enjoying the day-to-day. So kind of balancing all three of those things, or making, I don't think I'd be happy if I had great investment returns, but didn't spend enough time with my family. And I want to have high returns too, but I want to make sure I don't burn myself out and go over a long time period. And then also you want high returns, but for each person that means something different. I don't know. I don't have an exact number. I want to do as good a job as I can. And hopefully that can be higher than the S&P 500 over time, but that's a tough benchmark to beat. So keeping that in mind. So to answer your question, success, I think, is balancing, making sure I feel balanced in life with all those things I love.
I can relate to that. When I'm thinking of success, you know, there are three parts to it. You have the investment side, where we all want to have some respectable returns. There's a business side, especially if you're managing money for other people. And then there's the person behind it all. It's you and your quality of sleep, the diet that you have, your activity, and the fact that you will keep on showing up every day and have fun with it and not burn out. I think that's something that we don't talk about enough. And I think the last few years, they were very trying and challenging for a lot of investors showed that it's a tough business to be in, and it takes an emotional toll. And to have the right balance and harmony in all aspects of your life so that you will enjoy it and keep showing up the way Buffett and Munger are. They're way past the retirement age, and they seem to be still having as much fun as they did when they bought the first stock. So that's also very inspiring to see.
Yeah, definitely. They're role models in a lot of ways, and that's definitely one of them.
Exactly. Jacob, thank you so much. This was such a wonderful conversation, and you and I can talk about Berkshire for hours, but I think we touched on some really interesting aspects, and I think people will pick up your book and study more because there's so much more in it. And thank you for writing it and doing some remarkable research, putting it all together. And I didn't know that those details were available out there. So, you know, kudos to you for doing the work.
Thank you. Thanks for the kind words, and it was fun talking with you today.
Thank you, Jacob. You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.